I'm Mara Thibault of the Collegium Institute for Catholic Thought and Culture. Welcome to our annual Penn Club of New York reception. We gratefully acknowledge our co-sponsors and their representatives, First Things, the Portsmouth Institute for Faith and Culture, America Media, and the Thomas Merton Institute for Catholic Life at Columbia University. Tonight we welcome our distinguished scholars, our Board of Trustees, our current student fellows, members of our Young Alumni Council, Penn alumni of every generation, our donors and supporters, and new friends that we're meeting for the first time. I'm grateful to be among you, not only as a Collegium staff member, but also as a Penn alum myself and president of my beloved class of 1994. Together here tonight, we form an audience that reflects the very heart of the Collegium Institute mission at a time when our university community needs us the most. People from every background gather to listen, to learn, and to encounter each other through the big questions and the hard questions that unite us all. Your support enables Collegium to continue its vital mission of bringing the gift of religious tradition to life in the Secular Academy. Thank you so much for being here. And now please welcome to the podium the director of the Collegium Institute, Dr. Daniel Cheely.
Well, thank you so much, Maura, for that introduction. We still doing okay on sound? Yeah, I'm back. Okay, great. Well, look, it's an honor and pleasure to be here with you all for Collegium's 8th annual reception at the Penn Club of New York, but the first time in this main dining room. And so with your support, we've grown out of the Tarnable Room right into this main space. So thank you all for allowing us to be here. This annual event is really a celebration of all that you have made possible for Collegium to accomplish over this past academic year. But celebration is really only part of what we're doing here. These events are also an attempt to instantiate here in New York the kinds of conversations that we're trying to cultivate on campus. Conversations that address major contemporary issues of academic life, like last year's event that asked whether the university should teach virtue in the context of questions of inclusion and viewpoint diversity. These are also conversations that have marked important anniversaries, like the one on the 10-year anniversary of the financial crisis, the one on the 15-year anniversary of the revelations of the church abuse crisis. Tonight's event ambitiously attempts to do both of these things. On the one hand, it is a 15-year retrospective on the seminal Oxford University Press monograph, The Myth of Religious Violence, Secular Ideology and the Roots of Modern Conflict, authored by this evening's keynote speaker, Professor William Cavanaugh. But it takes up this book again precisely because of the global conflicts raging over the past 2 years. Global conflicts which in turn have escalated tension on our college campuses, leading in no small part to the resignation this fall of 2 university presidents, including our own. But that has not brought resolution either, as the continuing protests and counter-protests here on campuses in this city, but especially during this most sacred season of Passover, have made clear. So what are we to make of religious violence, of anti-Semitism, of anti-religious animus and threats to religious freedom, and of the capacity and or the responsibility of religious communities to serve as sources of reconciliation. To seed our reflection this evening, we'll have the privilege of hearing from three leading thinkers. I'll introduce them all at once, and only briefly now to save time for our conversation. But please refer to your program for slightly more information, a slightly more full exposition of some of their many achievements. Dr. William Cavanaugh is professor of Catholic Studies and director of the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology at DePaul University. In addition to The Myth of Religious Violence, he is the author of 8 other books, co-editor of 7 volumes, and author of over 100 articles and book chapters. His writings have been published in 17 languages, and he's lectured on 6 continents. We won't help him here with the 7th tonight, another time. But whatever land or academic space one might turn, Dr. Cavanaugh is acknowledged as the key interlocutor for any discussion about the stakes of acknowledging religious violence as an origin story for liberal Anglo-American politics. Dr. Timothy Shaw is distinguished research scholar in politics at the University of Dallas and director of the university's Maritain Program on Catholicism, Public Life, and World Affairs. With funding from the Templeton Religion Trust, he spearheaded an analysis of the religious freedom landscape, as well as viable religious freedom strategies in South and Southeast Asia. He has authored and edited numerous books, including God's Century, Resurgent Religion and Global Politics, Homo Religiosus, Exploring the Roots of Religion and Religious Freedom and Human Experience, and Under Caesar's Sword, Christian Responses to Persecution, among others. Our third speaker is Archbishop Boris Gujak, who is the Ukrainian Catholic Archbishop of Philadelphia and Metropolitan for the Ukrainian Catholic Church in the United States. He serves as chairman of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, the Committee on Domestic Justice and Human Development, which is quite enough in its own right. And saving his academic background in history and Harvard and his whole scholarly career for the bio that you have in your paper, we should emphasize instead his tireless work over these past 2 years, traveling back and forth between America and Ukraine. I mentioned this year just 8 times, to encourage the church suffering and nourish their hope amidst the tragic invasion of his home country. So thank you too, Archbishop, for your witness. We look forward to your reflections. So everyone here has much to say, and no doubt we have many questions to ask. So to afford time for that, we will strive for time discipline up here. Professor Cavanaugh will speak first for up to 20 minutes, followed by... Well, that sounds funny. He will speak first for up to 20 minutes, I repeat, followed by comments or brief remarks from Professor Shaw and Archbishop Gujak of 7 to 8 minutes each. We will save the rest of the time for discussion and Q&A, which will last until 8:15, formally. But informal, smaller group discussion can continue thereafter when we reopen the reception at that point until 9 p.m. So now, with much anticipation, I ask you to please join me in welcoming our three speakers, beginning first with Professor Cavanaugh.
Thanks so much, Dan and Maura, for arranging this event, and for all of you for coming out. It's it's really an honor. You may not be surprised to know that academic work doesn't always have a long shelf life. But to be here talking about this book after 15 years is really an honor and a pleasure. I was actually just settling into a fellowship at Notre Dame to start work on this book when a colleague knocked on the door and told me one fine September morning that an airliner had hit the World Trade Center. And so since then, by the time the book appeared in 2009, the idea that religion promotes violence was taken as obvious. My title would have been sounded something like The Myth of the Spherical Earth, right? But the book struck a chord largely because in some ways the myth is so prevalent. Now, some have tried to defend religion from the charge of violence by arguing that the causes aren't really religious, they're really economic or political. But I think those arguments are often refuted by the militants' own words, and they also assume the ability to kind of prize apart the political from the economic and the religious, and I'm not sure that's possible. Nor does it work to claim that the Crusaders were not really Christians, the Muslim militants are not really Muslims. I think normatively it's important to say, for Christians and Muslims to say that these people have got the faith wrong, but descriptively I think it's disingenuous to absolve our own co-religionists of wrongdoing in this way. People can and do commit violence in the name of their faith. But the common notion, what I call the myth of religious violence, is a stronger claim. It's the claim that religion has a greater propensity to promote violence than what is not religion, the secular. And the idea that religion promotes violence depends entirely, then, on this distinction between the religious and the secular, as in this table. Now, we commonly assume that things are neatly divided in this way between the religious and the secular. The secular matters have less of a tendency to promote violence because they have to do with purely mundane things. Religion, on the other hand, is peculiarly absolutist and divisive and irrational. But if we ask who has killed more people in the last 100 years, Muslims or atheists, the answer is atheists, and it's not even close. Deaths under atheist Marxist regimes are estimated as high as 110 million. The last 100 years have seen wars waged for oil and land and flags and free markets and democracy and ethnicity and a whole other host of secular causes, so-called. So what becomes of the myth of religious violence in the face of this evidence? For some, the answer to the problem is simple. You just move the offending ideologies over to the other side of the table. So atheist Christopher Hitchens, for example, takes this approach in his book, God Is Not Great, which is subtitled with typical British understatement, How Religion Poisons Everything. And he says, totalitarianism aims at human perfection, which is essentially a religious impulse. Religion poisons everything, in other words, because everything poisonous gets identified as religion. And at the same time, everything good ends up on the other side of the religious-secular divide. So he says of Martin Luther King, in no real as opposed to nominal sense, then was he a Christian, because he's not violent, right? So what's not violent can't be religious, because religion is defined as violent. And once you start examining arguments that religion promotes violence, we find that this religious-secular distinction is very fluid, and things are going back and forth that divide. In a book on public religion, Martin Marty argues that religion has a peculiar tendency to be divisive and violent, but Marty lists 17 different definitions of religion and then begs off giving his own definition, and instead he gives a list of what he calls 5 features that mark a religion, which is not a definition, he says, but then he proceeds to show how politics fits all 5 of the same features. So what becomes of the religious-secular distinction here? Another example, Mark Juergensmeyer, probably the leading scholar on religion and violence, says religion ratchets divisions up to a cosmic level, but he also writes secular nationalism is a religion, and the secular is a sort of advanced form of religion. So what becomes of the religious secular divide if the secular is a form of religion? Some religion and violence theorists openly expand the category of religion. Richard Wentz's book, Why People Do Bad Things in the Name of Religion, includes consumerism, secular humanism, football fanaticism, faith in technology, and a host of other ideologies and practices under the rubric of religion, and he concludes, perhaps all of us do bad things in the name of religion. And so he basically takes everything for which people do violence and labels it religion. Now, he's what's often called a functionalist, that is, a scholar who believes that religion is whatever functions like one. And there's a vast literature on Marxism as a religion, for example, if you compare those images. There's an extensive body of scholarship on nationalism as a religion. And there's lots of examples of this. This is the Bellamy salute before Hitler made this gesture unpopular in the 1930s. This is the Capitol building, the apotheosis, the becoming God of Washington. A survey of religious studies literature finds the following treated under the rubric religion: totems, witchcraft, human rights, liberalism, Freudianism, Japanese tea ceremonies, sports, free market ideology, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the list goes on and on. Now, at this point, you're probably thinking, well, that's just wrong, right? I know what religion is. It's belief in God or God. So just go back to that first slide. But some things on this list that are usually called religions, such as Taoism and Confucianism and many forms of Buddhism, don't have a central concept of God or gods. So we could say, okay, let's expand the definition of religion to belief in transcendence or some more inclusive term. But if we do that, then all sorts of practices, including many that are usually labeled secular, fall under the definition of religion. So expanding the concept of religion to include godless Buddhism makes it difficult to exclude godless Marxism. Now, so all of that is, I do that at great length in the book. And if it all sounds like academic hair splitting, it's really nothing more complicated than what the Bible says about idolatry. People treat all kinds of things as gods, golden calves and armies and mammon and even their own bellies, as Paul says to the Philippians. So put simply, my argument is that people kill for all sorts of things. There's no reason to suppose that people are more likely to kill for a god than for a flag or the workers' revolution. Now, I think it helps if we stop thinking of religion as a thing out there that we just have a really hard time defining. The religious-secular distinction is a modern Western invention that's constructed in different ways to serve different purposes, and it helps if we ask in each circumstance what those purposes are. So the Romans had the term religio, but there was no religion-politics distinction. How could you when Caesar is a god, right? Augustine writes that religio is an attitude of respect in relations between a man and his neighbor, which is, of course, nothing like what we mean by the term. In the medieval era, the religious-secular distinction was the distinction between clergy who belonged to an order and diocesan clergy. Again, nothing like what we mean. So much nonsense, I think, gets written about religion because we assume it's a separate area of life cordoned off from mundane affairs, but other times and places don't have any such concept, right? So if you ask, is Aztec politics to blame for their bloody human sacrifices, or is it Aztec religion? Well, the question is an anachronism. It just doesn't make sense. The religious-secular distinction as we know it today was a creation of the early modern struggles for power between ecclesiastical and civil authorities in Europe. In the creation of the modern state, religion was invented as an essentially interior and private impulse separate from politics and other secular concerns. So henceforth, the civil authorities could tell the church to stick to religion and stay out of politics. The religious-secular distinction was then exported to the rest of the world during the process of colonization. According to Wilfred Cantwell Smith, there is, quote, no closely equivalent concept to religion in any culture that has not been influenced by the modern West. And in fact, in their initial encounters with non-Western people, European explorers reported back home with remarkable consistency that the natives had no religion at all. Once colonized, however, the category religion often became a powerful tool for the classification of native cultures as essentially distinct from the business of government. Hinduism became a religion in the 19th century, despite the fact that it encompassed the entire Indian way of life, everything we would include under culture, politics, religion, and economy. If under British rule, Hinduism was a religion, then to be Indian was to be private, and to be British was to be public. And that's why contemporary advocates of Hindu nationalism refuse to call Hinduism a religion. The religious-secular distinction, in other words, is not engraved in the nature of things. It's a distinction employed in westernized societies to marginalize certain kinds of beliefs and practices and authorize others. So the last part of the book then asks, if it's so incoherent, why is it so prevalent? Whose purposes does this myth of religious violence serve? And so I look at both domestic policy and foreign policy. Until the 1940s, religion was cited in U.S. Supreme Court cases as having a unifying social effect. And beginning in the 1940s, it was cited as a potentially dangerous and divisive social force. Why the shift at a time when, you know, denominational tensions were probably at their lowest point in history? Precisely because the establishment was becoming more secular, and secularism needs the danger of religion as a foil to justify itself. That's part of what I try to spell out in the book. So the first Supreme Court decision to invoke the myth of religious violence was Minersville School District versus Gobitis, which ruled that Jehovah's Witnesses could be forced to salute the flag because their dissent threatened national cohesion. Nationalism was the cure for the divisiveness of religion. Martin Marty discusses this case and cites the many violent attacks on Jehovah's Witnesses in the 1940s because they believed that the followers of Jesus Christ should not salute a flag. Now, one would think that he would draw the obvious conclusion that nationalism can cause violence, but astonishingly, he concludes it became obvious that religion carries risks and can be perceived by others as dangerous. Religion can cause all kinds of trouble in the public arena. And here, the myth of religious violence is used to draw attention away from nationalist violence and towards so-called religious violence, even though the Jehovah's Witnesses were the ones getting the crap beat out of them, right? Now, in succeeding decades, the myth of religious violence would be invoked by the Supreme Court in case after case, banning school prayer, forbidding state aid to parochial school teachers, and so on, causing Justice Potter Stewart in dissent to warn of, quote, the establishment of a religion of secularism, end quote. So that's domestic policy. Then in foreign policy, the myth of religious violence helps reinforce Western attitudes towards the non-Western world. We tell ourselves that we have a peaceful, secular type of state in which religion has been marginalized from the public sphere, while those crazy people over there, Muslims especially, still mix religion with politics, which makes their politics dangerous. And so we find ourselves regrettably forced to bomb them into the higher rationality. That was a joke. So I give many examples of this kind of logic in the book. Hitchens was a cheerleader for the Iraq War, which he considered part of the broader war for secularism. Fellow New Atheist Sam Harris wrote, "There is, in fact, no talking to some people. War is what we and other Western powers are bound to attempt at an even greater cost to ourselves and innocents abroad, elsewhere in the Muslim world. We will continue to spill blood in what is, at bottom, a war of ideas." So in other words, religious people hold irrational beliefs, so you can't reason with them. You can only deal with them by force. And the myth of religious violence thus becomes a kind of justification for the use of violence. even where the myth of religious violence is not used directly to justify violence, it's often used indirectly to cast a fog of amnesia over Western interventions in the Muslim world. We attribute the Iranian Revolution of 1979 to religious fanaticism, which allows us to ignore the previous 26 years of the Shah's reign, in which a secularist regime installed by a U.S.-backed coup in 1953 tortured and killed thousands with full U.S. support. Now, my point is not to defend the theocrats of Iran, but rather to level the playing field so that we examine the violence that can be generated by the concept of jihad, but we also examine the violence that can be generated by ideologies of free markets and free elections. We need an empirical approach to violence, examining not the violence of religion or Islam as a whole, but this particular 18th century school of Wahhabism, this particular American intervention, and so on. Now, my mind has changed on some matters since I published the book, so you just got, like, in 17 minutes, the whole book in a nutshell. I'm just going to talk about how what has changed and how my mind has changed. I used to avoid the term religion altogether, and now I see that it can be useful in some contexts, as in some uses of the idea of religious freedom, for example. And I think the world has changed too. The idea that religion promotes violence crested after the 9/11 attacks, when the right wanted to justify wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the left wanted to promote secularism without appearing Islamophobic. So religion in general was the target. Now, that moment has passed, and I like to think as well that my book maybe put a dent, at least in the academic discourse on religion and violence. But the myth of religious violence is still invoked in many different contexts, and in some ways that's unsurprising. One of the things I argue is that the myth of religious violence is part and parcel of the ideology of liberal secularism. It can be traced all the way back to Hobbes and Locke. The idea that we cannot disagree on fundamental matters of belief without killing one another is essential to the justification of secularism, and it doesn't depend on actual evidence to support it, right? So one of the things I show in the book is that the so-called wars of religion in historical fact were nothing like what liberal theorists claim, but they need violent religion as a foil. But recent events have affected the way that the myth of religious violence is used. The response to the violence in Gaza has led to a spike in both Islamophobia and anti-Semitism in the U.S., as some people home in on what they consider religion to be the cause. Anti-Semitism, when it's actually anti-Semitism and not just criticism of Israel's actions, focuses on Judaism as the cause. On the other side, the myth of religious violence is operative when religious fanaticism is isolated as the cause of Hamas militancy, thus allowing us to downplay the Israeli treatment of Palestinians. We in the West have a tendency to throw up our hands and say, well, what are you going to do? Those people over there, they've been fighting religious wars for centuries. And that gives the status quo a pass. All of that kind of looks familiar to me. What I didn't anticipate in the book was the rise of Christian nationalism in the US and in Russia and other places. George W. Bush was a Christian, but the architects of the Iraq War were not Christian nationalists, they were secularists. Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld and others associated with the Project for the New American Century. Trumpism, on the other hand, is not imperialist and not secularist. The idea that religion causes violence is invoked now on the left to warn of the dangers of Bible thumpers turning the U.S. into a theocracy. Now, I think Christian nationalism is a problem. For me as a Christian, however, the problem is not the Christianity, but the nationalism. The problem is not that religion inevitably causes problems when it's let out into the public sphere. The problem is not mixing theology with politics. The problem, I think, is mixing bad theology with bad politics. Christian nationalism, from my point of view, is a perversion of the gospel a bizarre folk religion that has substituted the nation for God. Christian nationalism, like nationalism in general, is idolatrous collective self-worship. And that's the point of the book, in many ways. People worship and kill for all kinds of things that are not God. Nationalism evokes real virtues of self-sacrifice for others, but tends toward idolatry. And that is the theme of my new book, which just came out in January, which is a sequel to The Myth of Religious Violence. If the earlier book was a challenge to secularist dismissals of religion, the new book is equally a challenge to Christian forms of idolatry. And I think my 20 minutes is up, so I'll look forward to continuing the discussion. Thank you.
Friends of the Collegium Institute, good evening, Dan Sheely, and all leaders of the Collegium, including Maura Thibault, without whom we would not have this event. You've been the sine qua non. And good evening also to my daughter, Miriam. It's wonderful to have you. Miriam just graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. And I'm very proud of her, including what she contributed, and also very grateful for what she benefited from the Collegium Institute. I couldn't be happier or feel more privileged to share the stage this evening with two people whom I regard as great heroes of the Catholic Christian faith in our time, the Most Reverend Metropolitan Archbishop Boris Gudziak and Professor William Kavanaugh. I don't know who is facing the tougher opponent, Boris Gudziak and facing the Russian bear, or Bill Kavanaugh facing the challenges of teaching in a Catholic university. I do admire both of them greatly. The title of my exceptionally brief remarks is The Myth of Religious Violence 15 Years Later, Congratulations or Condolences. Because as much as I admire the cogency and courage of Bill Kavanaugh, intellectual integrity demands an honest interrogation of his core arguments, as valuable as some of them undoubtedly are. And intellectual integrity also demands that we in the Collegium Institute ask ourselves whether this is the right time to celebrate the central thrust of Bill's book. Is Bill's argument both true and helpful for our world today? First, forgive me, I'm going to quote from Bill's book. First, what is the thrust of Bill Kavanaugh's book? I think there are two core components, and I'm going to set an example by reading from Bill's book, and that I urge all of you to get your hands on your own copy if you don't already have one, because it is absolutely well worth reading and studying these 15 years later. The first thrust of Bill's book is from page 5. What I challenge as incoherent is the argument that there is something called religion, a genus of which Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and so on are species, which is necessarily more inclined toward violence than our ideologies and institutions that are identified as secular. And the second thrust comes on page 6. The conventional wisdom is that there is an essential difference between religions such as Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, and Judaism on the one hand, and secular ideologies and institutions such as nationalism, Marxism, capitalism, and liberalism on the other, and that the former are essentially more prone to violence, more absolutist, divisive, and irrational than the latter. It is this claim that I find both unsustainable and dangerous. It is unsustainable because ideologies and institutions labeled secular can be just as absolutist, divisive, and irrational as those labeled religious. It is dangerous because it helps to marginalize and even legitimate violence against those forms of life that are labeled religious. What gets labeled religious and what does not is therefore of crucial importance. The myth of religious violence tries to establish as timeless, universal, and natural a very contingent set of categories, religious and secular, that are in fact constructions of the modern West. Those who do not accept these categories as timeless, universal, and rational are subject to coercion. Now, my first observation those thoughts and the thrust of Bill's book is that my sense is that Bill's forceful denial of any strong general connection between religion as such and violence compels one to recall Queen Gertrude's line from Hamlet, "The lady doth protest too much, methinks." Ordinary folks who walked in on a group of academics in the year 2024 who are suggesting, quote unquote, that religious violence is a myth might be forgiven for thinking that this is one more sign of the madness and insanity of modern academia. But wait, a bunch of you are ordinary folks, and you have walked in on us here, and you have found us saying or suggesting that religious violence is a kind of myth, and maybe you're thinking that academia has gone mad after all, or at least we're protesting too much. For let's look at the world around us honestly. Our world since the beginning of 2023 has been turned upside down by two horrific, violent conflicts. At this very moment, a Russian government, animated by a Russian Orthodox-infused nationalism, is ravaging Ukraine, egged on by the patriarch Kirill, who is suggesting that martyrdom in the cause of subjugating Ukraine to Russian control will take Russian soldiers directly to heaven. While at the same moment, the State of Israel, led by a government strongly shaped by religious Zionist ideology and rhetoric, is battling a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas, in a death struggle in Gaza. While I entirely agree with Bill Kavanaugh that it's wrong to impose a monocausal framework on conflicts such as those two major conflicts, it also seems a rank violation of common sense and empirical reality to deny that religion in some sense is a strong and causally significant component of each of these conflicts, turning the world upside down today at this very moment. I suspect His Grace Archbishop Gudziak would agree. So while it might be true in some theoretical sense that religion is not necessarily more prone to violence than secular actors or ideologies, this would seem to be an awkward moment to insist too strongly on that point. At the very least, in 2024, in the midst of the kinds of horrific, religiously motivated violence called for by Patriarch Kirill, called for and inflicted by Hamas on October 7th, called for by members of the cabinet of Prime Minister Netanyahu, and inflicted by Zionist settlers in recent weeks on Palestinians in the West Bank, the idea of the myth of religious violence would seem to have a serious PR problem. And not just PR in the sense of public relations, but PR in the sense of political reality. And the examples could be multiplied. My wife, Rebecca, and I live in India, which is now having national elections, and the current election cycle began with the Prime Minister of India effectively presiding over the consecration of a Hindu temple dedicated to Lord Ram in January. And there is little doubt that the path and the effort to constructing that temple in Ayodhya have been associated with enormous religious violence by Hindus and by Muslims, animated by competing religious beliefs and narratives and competing religiously inflected concepts of Indian national identity without pinning blame necessarily or praise on any one particular side in these conflicts. Now, Bill Kavanaugh is rightly going to say, wait a minute, the violence in places like Ukraine, the Middle East, and South Asia can't be reduced to religious explanation alone, both because, in his view, there is no universal category of religion that can be used to unify the very different religious actors and ideas at play in these very different contexts, and because secular actors and ideas have often played a hidden and deliberately hidden role in many of these conflict zones. Here, I partially agree and partially disagree with Bill Kavanaugh. I partially disagree in that we simply cannot have a coherent conversation about whether religious violence is or is not a myth or an exaggeration without some, even if imperfect, trans-contextual concepts such as religion. If I may say so, I think Bill wants to be a nominalist when it comes to religion. More or less, acknowledging that there are religious particulars while denying that there are universal religious concepts and universal religious principles or criteria for determining what does and does not count as religious. Furthermore, his position is not just epistemic, but moral and political. He believes that the very invention of religion as a generic category based on transcultural universals or essences was indissolubly conjoined with, and that it also indispensably aided, the nefarious political project of modern liberalism. In his view, and rightly in my view, the modern so-called liberalism of Spinoza, Hobbes, Locke, and others conceived of religion as a separable category, a separable compartment of social life, precisely to contain and to control it, to subject it to the systematic surveillance and control of the state. Furthermore, this secular liberal project of control of religion has been at least as great a source of conflict and violence and oppression in the modern world as religious actors and ideologies. With all of that, I am in enthusiastic agreement. In India, I think, helps prove Bill's point. The hard-edged secularism of Jawaharlal Nehru in the two decades after Indian independence, followed by the hard-edged secularism of his daughter, Indira Gandhi, was often backed by the aggressive use of state power, and it played a direct role in inspiring the Hindu nationalist counter-revolution in India that we are seeing right now unfolding as we speak. In explaining religious militancy, in this case the religious militancy of the Hindu nationalist movement, arguably the largest religious militant movement in the entire world, in other words, Bill is profoundly correct that you cannot neatly separate secular factors from religious factors. And indeed, as he just suggested in his remarks, much of what we call Islamic militancy and violence, whether originating in Iran or in Egypt, has partly been a reaction to and intertwined with aggressively secularist and secularizing states and ideologies in the Middle East, often supported, as he noted, by the West. So Bill is to be congratulated enthusiastically for insisting on these points with such force and clarity. However, where I disagree with Bill is the following. I don't believe that Bill's nominalism vis-a-vis religion is philosophically desirable or even possible. Bill himself presupposes, it seems to me, that there are some phenomena that rightly count as religious. For example, in his excellent chapter in The Myth of Religious Violence on the so-called European Wars of Religion, even as he denies that religion is a meaningful genus or generic category. But I don't think Bill can have his cake and eat it too. To use Max Weber's concepts, there have to be at least some focal cases or central cases of religion with explicit criteria as to what counts as central cases across contexts in order to make the very kinds of valuable arguments that Bill wants to make. You can't ultimately and convincingly speak of the myth of religious violence if there is no such thing as religion. And you can't say that religious actors are not necessarily or inherently more violent than secular actors if religion is an entirely meaningless category doomed to nominalist disintegration. As a historical and normative matter, I also think it's not correct to argue that the generic category of religion was invented or appeared for the first time in or by the modern West as part of a technology of statist political control, as Bill argues. Here's just one example. The great Dominican Bartolomé de las Casas, the great defender of the Indians in the late 15th and early 16th centuries, was, of course, many, many things. As my friend David Lantigua at Notre Dame shows, one of the things that he unquestionably was a sophisticated ethnographer of the religious diversity and complexity of the Indians of the Americas. Long before, and totally conceptually independently of modern liberalism, obviously, de las Casas unquestionably believed that religion was a distinct social phenomenon understood as that ensemble of exterior sacrificial rites whereby people seek to honor and come into harmony with God or the gods, i.e. that necessary divine being or necessary divine beings on whom we contingent human beings are radically dependent. In deep conceptual debt to Cicero and St. Thomas Aquinas, De las Casas' careful and sympathetic study of Amerindian religion led him to the conclusion that making offerings and sacrifices was a universal religious behavior. And even though this took the form of human sacrifice, notoriously, in some Amerindian communities, such as the Aztecs, as Bill noted in his remarks, this did not deter De las Casas from seeing Amerindian sacrificial religions in all their diversity and the Christian religion, in which, of course, a great sacrifice is a central component, as all part of the same, broadly speaking, religious family. And what is furthermore most interesting for our purposes is that this conceptual and definitional move on the part of De las Casas was not designed to condemn Amerindian religion to adverse judgment and control by superior Westerners. Rather, it was designed precisely to bring Amerindian religion and Christianity into the same conversational space. It was designed to bring Christianity and Amerindian religion into theological proximity to each other, so that the love and truth of the gospel without coercion could be brought to the Amerindians more effectively. Furthermore, this move by De las Casas to make both Amerindian religion and Christianity species belonging to the same genus of sacrificial religions was also equally designed to defend and protect the Amerindians from Western manipulation, coercion, conquest, and Western claims that the West had the right to make war against them because of their so-called barbarism. Conceptual clarity about the distinct nature and role of the religious sacrificial systems of the native peoples served a political agenda that, in a sense, was designed to protect the rights and freedom of the Amerindians. In other words, a political agenda precisely the opposite of the coercive, Erastian political agenda of, say, Hobbes and Spinoza, that inspired them to conceptualize religion as a universal category, distinct and isolable from other compartments of social life, such as the political, precisely in order to control those compartments. But I think in a way that this helps to make one of Bill's crucial and important and valid points, that religion and politics do not appear as self-defining categories. They do not always bear the meanings, the contingent and questionable meanings that liberal theorists have constructed and imposed upon them. So to return to the question that served as the title of my remarks, congratulations or condolences. On the one hand, I worry that Bill's work goes too far in letting religion off the hook. Religion is lending itself, I believe, around the world to political and violent weaponization in too many obvious cases around the world. For us to speak too quickly or casually about the myth of religious violence. And I think it was in appropriate recognition of this fact that the Roman Catholic Church, for example, took responsibility for some of the violence that it caused in issuing documents such as Nostra Aetate and Dignitatis Humanae at the Second Vatican Council nearly 60 years ago. And yet in the end, given the prevailing prejudices at bastions of intellectual respectability at such places as the University of Pennsylvania and Midtown Manhattan, despite my quibbles and misgivings, Bill is finally to be warmly congratulated for puncturing the, in fact, religious mythology by which liberals and liberalism claim to offer the only paths to political salvation in a violent world. For modern liberalism does in fact claim that outside the liberal church there is no moral or social salvation. The achievement of Bill Kavanaugh is to force us to examine this unquestioned and, in some contexts, unquestionable orthodoxy for what it is, an orthodoxy that rests on creedal assumptions that can be exposed as without foundation, and moreover, an ideology that has authorized violence on a massive scale and, in some respects, continues to do so. At the same time, Bill's remorselessly clear and cogent analysis forces us to consider alternative paths to political peace and to political salvation in our undeniably violent and conflict-ridden 21st century. And for all of that, Bill deserves heartiest congratulations. Thank you.
Center of Professor Kavanaugh's argument is the development of the concept of religion in modern times. I don't know if you'll call it 300 or 400 or 500 years. We as children of God, as followers of our Lord Jesus Christ, as educated people, we of course know that the context of our life in the Spirit is very vast. Astronomers, geophysicists will tell us that the universe is 40 or 50 billion years old, that it is 40 or 50 billion light years in radius, I think. It changes, the theories. And I suspect that there will be many millennia, and maybe millions of years to come. And the question is, what does God the Creator think about religion? What we're talking about is pretty much recorded historical experience, maybe the stuff that was epic before it became epic in oral tradition, before it was written down a few thousand years. But we have a Lord that holds this earth in his right hand that is billions of years old, according to what science tells us. And we have a God that sends his Son into this world in a very concrete way. This is the greatest mystery, greatest paradox, and greatest joy of our faith. That God so loved the world that he sent his only begotten Son so that we may not perish, that we may live. Like in one place, one time. We're kind of counting from there, 20-odd years. I think there's something very important in that is even broader than the violence argument in Professor Kavanaugh's presentation in his book. I really don't think God is interested in religion, particularly as it's being defined by the Enlightenment, the liberal Western intellectual tradition. If you look at Jesus the Semite, he wasn't even very Hellenic. I don't know, you correct me, I don't think his Greek was that great, probably. If you look at the way he speaks, the way he teaches, the way he relates, it's not first the system, it's not first a corporation, it's not first a set of rules, but it's a relationship that the Lord invites us into. A relationship that happens here, but is conditioned by, is in the matrix of the relationship of God the Father with his creation and his creatures. That's what Jesus is interested in. Everything else can help that, or it can get in its way. And I think all of us can confess, those of us who are practicing, can confess how much the different rituals, rules, practices, traditions of the church help us order things. But maybe now better than ever, after the abuse crisis, after, I hope, we can see that in all of that, there can be great danger. And there can be danger of violence. Because the subtext of what we heard so far was basically wars. But there's all kinds of different violence. So to finish with my first point, I think there's a very deep insight which points to the hubris of modernity. And I think fundamentally Professor Kavanaugh is right that maybe not exclusively, but at least partially, religion is named as such, is categorized as such, is accused as such to control it and put it on its side. And Jesus told us, in other words, that would happen. What is being put aside is bad religion, the kind that God, I think, is not interested in, but the baby is thrown out with the bathwater. And our penchant, the Western great gift of reason, even in theology, has arrived at paradoxes. For an Eastern Christian, or for theologians of the first millennium, it would be very confusing to see a theological curriculum where you have what is called systematic theology, or dogmatic theology, you know, the study of the Trinity, of Christ, of the Holy Spirit, what the church is, etc. And then to see subjects called spirituality, or John Chrysostom, Basil the Great. What kind of dogmatics are there that are not speaking about spirituality? The rationalistic approach to so many things has divided. And I believe the creation, or this process which Professor Kavanaugh describes, is a part of that penchant to categorize, to divide, to try to control. And there's an intellectual hubris in that. Besides the fact that it leads to the kind of othering that is at the heart of Professor Kavanaugh's argument. Point two. The topic, the book is called The Myth of Religious Violence. Is that correct? And we've talked about religion a lot. But how about violence? It's just not wars. It's just not what's going on, you know, in Ukraine or in the Holy Land, or what has happened during the so-called wars of the religion in Europe, or 9/11, the big acts of terror. In the United States, there's a big problem of violence. Kyiv, which is besieged, which is being hit by rockets, the capital of Ukraine, suffers fewer homicides than Chicago. People ask you, are you not afraid to go? I said, you're more likely to get killed in Philadelphia. or Chicago. And you know what St. Louis and Baltimore are at the top of our list. There's so much juvenile violence. Violence that is growing. And what's at the root of that violence? Is it the religion that we experience in our churches, our synagogues, our mosques? I've never really seen any significant violence in any of our religious communities. In fact, across the board, I would say they're welcoming. I was in a Buddhist monastery 3 weeks ago in California. I was at a Seder on Monday night. I'm in all kinds of Christian churches at different times. Listen to some Muslim intellectuals. Basically, religion, as we see it experienced in our communities, is a place of healing, a place of peace, a place of friendship, hospitality, often excellent food. What is causing the violence? Instability in the home, broken families, unemployment of parents, low income, low parental involvement in the life of their children. I'm talking right now about the juvenile violence. The domestic violence in the family. I don't think a husband beats up a wife in the name of the Lord, or because God is great. Early access to alcohol and drugs. The proliferation in access to weapons. The lack of positive examples and the proliferation of negative ones. Bad role models, all those movies. You don't need religion when you have children watching films that show a murder every 30 seconds. Some kind of killing. And then the untreated trauma. I was in San Francisco. The streets filled with people with mental disease. And those streets are not locations of great peace. There's a lot of violence there. So, yes, there's massive violence and there's wars. And religion has a role in that. But our sinfulness allows for a lot of violence to be happening next door. And I would venture to say some of the liberal postulates have contributed to this kind of violence. Finally, I want to say something about Ukraine. Maybe that'll be of interest. And this war which is an incredible menace, not only to the people in Ukraine, but to you and me. It is true, as Professor Shah says, that the Russian Orthodox Church is basically, as a public institution and in its statements, completely behind this war. But can it be called a religious war? There have actually been about 660 churches destroyed by the Russians in Ukraine, damaged or destroyed. Most of them are churches of the Moscow Patriarchate. They're hitting their own churches of their own jurisdiction. The Moscow Patriarchate, the Russian Orthodox Church in Russia, on the one hand, has no dissident bishops. No, not a single of one of the 400 bishops has spoken out against this war. And the few priests that have been sanctioned. Some of them have been defrocked, have been what in the Catholic system would be called laicized. Why? because they've refused to pray for victory. They pray for peace. And there's an official prayer about this war, and they pray for peace instead of praying for Russian victory. And you get defrocked from it. It's clear the church is behind this war. However, this is not a religious war in a majority sense or prevalent sense. And this is something that is so difficult for people to understand. From Bush Senior to Bush Junior, from Clinton to Obama, from Trump, even to Biden. From Prodi to Berlusconi, if you know the Italian political greed. Center left, far right. Merkel, and before her, Schröder. I sat next to, in Davos 15 months ago, next to former Prime Minister Blair, and I would mention Macron with him in France, and much more so his predecessor, who now is being tried for corruption. Remind me of his name. Sarkozy, yeah. Incredible naivete. The Germans thought Wandel durch Handel, change through business. We're going to do business with them and we're going to kind of bring them over. Same thing, Italians. Holy Father, let's meet in Cuba, elsewhere. But there's a lack of seeing that it is not just the religion. Deep in Russian culture, there's a phenomenon, which is, I think, somewhere on Professor Kavanaugh's list. Colonial imperialism. Colonialism and imperialism. See, we don't believe that white people can be colonized. The victims of colonialism are only colored people. Did you ever hear of Russian colonialism? Well, that's exactly what it is. How did those Russians from Eastern Europe get to Alaska? You know how many ethnic groups they trampled along the way? Over 100. Not to mention the Georgians, Armenians, Ukrainians, Latvians, Estonians, Lithuanians, Belarusians. But this is not understood. Kirill can be for this war, or he can be against this war. It's not going to make that big a difference. Religion is not the leading cause. Ironically, the Russian world idea, which Putin is using, was developed by Kirill. But only 2% of Russians go to church. Most are secular. In the contemporary understanding of the term, they might be superstitious, but they're not practicing, convinced, orthodox, for whom the gospel of Jesus Christ is an orientation in life. So we have a big context. We have the invitation of our Lord to live in communion. We need things that are incarnate. We need structures. We need buildings. We need rules. We need laws. We need ritual. But this is what Pope Francis, this is one of his big intuitions. I said he doesn't get it all on, didn't get it always all on the war in Ukraine. But he is saying, you know, this religion stuff, it's important that you individually and we as a community be with the Lord. That is what the Christian faith is. That is what life in Christ is all about. We need to be holistic. the rationalistic approach of Western culture has brought us great progress, great discoveries. It's going to give us AI. But we're probably one of the most lonely societies in human history. And that loneliness is causing physical diseases and mental illnesses. Our Surgeon General wrote a book about it. So this holistic call is something that is akin to Professor Kavanaugh's argument, where religion is othered. Let's look at the violence in all of its categories, that which really is so close on our streets. And I don't think religion is a cause, not one iota. And in Ukraine, I believe religion, which I eschew generally, life in Christ is going to prevail. Because God's truth always does. Eventually, it needs to be you and me, Christians of today and tomorrow, that lead to reconciliation and healing. But in the meantime, the killers have to be stopped. Thanks for getting your senators and congressmen to vote. Thank you.